In this last lecture, I want to discuss a few general topics that I saved until the conclusion of the course, one of the most important of which will be the concept of the institution of marriage. I want to talk a little bit about affairs, in contradistinction to living together, in contradistinction to marriage itself. One of the consequences of the religious preoccupation with people avoiding sexual sin, you'll remember what I said in the first or second lecture about how much of religious ethics has to do with cataloging specifically sexual prohibitions. One of the consequences of this dominant religious approach is, as I pointed out then, that many people, when they hear the word morality, assume right away that you are talking about sexual morality. If you say a person is moral, certain people will understand this to mean he or she doesn't sleep around, because there is this strong intimate association. However, this is a quite fallacious view. I do not believe there is such a thing as a specific sexual morality, which view happens to be one of the consequences or hangovers from this earlier view. That is to say, the notion that there is some systematic set of rules for sexual conduct. I don't believe it's the purpose of a rational system of ethics to lay out rules of that kind. Ethics is concerned with broad general principles, ways of facing life, dealing with reality, the setting of the broad basic goals of our existence. It's not concerned with giving people a set of commandments or rules. First of all, because rational people don't accept commandments. Rational people can accept
Once you get beyond that, I think governments ought to look to the major industries to see if special measures are needed because of the particular circumstances of those industries. When mining has prospered in Australia, there have been some tax arrangements, for example, that have applied to the mining industry that have not applied in the same way to other industries, but the industries are different. There are some arrangements that apply for the protection of manufacturing industries that don't and can't apply to primary industries, again because the industries are different. And therefore I think governments have to look overall to the industry to see what ought to be done. But I don't regard this as establishing handouts or support of that kind. I regard it as part of the task of establishing a total environment which will enable that industry to operate and prosper in its own interest, and in the interest, in our case, of Australia and of Australians. It's quite a different matter if somebody comes along, as one of mine did the other day, and said, we need $150,000 a month subsidy to keep open. I said, well, you know, that's not on.
being a Kalgoorlie man, I'll probably have to put in a commercial for Kalgoorlie at the end of the sessions.
Well, you might, but we've done certain other things and referred the matter back to the IAC, as
right,
you know.
Sure.
But the deputation that came to see me about Kalgoorlie didn't support that proposition.
Sure.
Anyway, in broad terms, there's another element where the government's got a role, and that is to protect the national interest. I think in 1976 and beyond, the days of complete open door in relation to mining, just come in, dig it up, take it away, without any regard to local equity and the national interest, are gone. But in protecting the national interest, the government is at the same time protecting the equity of the foreign investor, because you establish sane and sensible arrangements which would prevent any raids by irresponsible governments of the future, mm-hmm. because the general circumstances and environment is accepted. And this, in large measure, is the purpose of our foreign investment guidelines, to establish such an arrangement.
Yeah, I had a question on this foreign investment guideline and the feeling that I've had reading accounts on what your position has been for the foreign investment guideline is that somehow you're soft-pedaling the particular policy for investment guideline. The Australian capital market is very thin. What happens if, let's say, an American mining company wants to invest its capital in Australia and has trouble finding an Australian partner with 50% equity?
Well, we're not soft-pedaling the policy. The policy hasn't varied from the day it was altered. But in the circumstance you mentioned, that American company would go to the Foreign Investment Review Board, it would get a decision very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so long as the project is regarded in the national interest, it would go ahead. Now, the national interest is defined fairly broadly, and I don't believe that hitherto there have been any rejections by that particular committee. Part of the purpose of the committee is just to convince itself that a genuine attempt has been made to get an Australian partner, to get Australian equity. But right from the outset, we said that if a particular operation can't attract 50% Australian equity, the main objective would still be to get projects moving. You know, take the North West Shelf, for example, the amount of capital involved in that. To achieve 50% equity in the totality of the spending that will be involved is, I think, a virtually impossible task. But nobody wants the North West Shelf held up because of that. Mm-hmm. We want it to go ahead. And the same general approach would apply to mining ventures, wherever they are.
Mr. Fraser, inflation hurts everybody, individuals, corporations. In the case of corporations, it undercuts their ability to finance their own projects. And mining is extremely capital intensive. You are fighting inflation. Your budget proves it. What type of policies or mix of policies will you be putting in effect to reduce inflation?
Well, I think the policies are all down, on the ground and spelt out, basically. We've reduced government expenditure very greatly indeed. Federal government outlays are up 11% this year. They're up 23% the year before and 46% the year before that. And the extent of those increases obviously fueled inflation very greatly. You can't pull it right back in one go, but I think we've pulled government expenditure back as far as we can, certainly for the first year. Secondly, while the deficit is still by some standards high, it's a deficit of quite a different kind, because it's not made up merely of government expenditure. If it had been the same sort of budget as last year, the deficit would have been much less than that indicated. The difference is made up by concessions to relieve the tax burden on individuals and to relieve the tax burden on companies and businesses, so that the private enterprise sector has room to breathe and to grow. Part of the anti-inflationary process is obviously getting much more common sense into the wage-fixing arena. And over three national wage cases over the three quarters of this year, I believe there's been a considerable advance. In the first quarter, our arguments were rejected, but that began to establish a climate in which, in the second quarter, the Arbitration Commission and in the third quarter made decisions much less than full wage indexation, giving us an opportunity to wind back inflation in a way that would not have been possible if full indexation had flowed through. Mm-hmm. And that approach to wage fixing will certainly be continued. We'll continue to keep a tight rein on government expenditures, and we'll continue to keep very close watch on monetary policy. In the budget speech, the Treasurer set down the general objectives in this area. While the government has to be able to preserve some flexibility of approach if circumstances change markedly, the monetary policy will be geared in such a way that it in itself doesn't further fuel inflation, but in fact acts as a restraining hand. That's a delicate task, as you'd understand, because if the restraining hand is too firm, people start to talk about a credit squeeze, and that wouldn't be in our interests, in the interest of Australia either, in the present circumstances.
Yes. Incidentally, I studied economics at one time under Alan Greenspan. Now, Jerry Ford, thanks to Alan Greenspan and Arthur Burns and William Simon, has been able to...
I had lunch with Arthur Burns.
You did?
In Washington, a short while ago.
Anyhow, he's been able to slash inflation by half, and whenever I've been asked here in Australia, do you think Fraser will be able to get the trick? I say, well, why not? Newspaper people in the States say that Jerry Ford can chew gum and walk at the same time, and my reply to that is that Mr. Fraser is a big man, and he apparently is able to chew gum and walk at the same time, so he should be able to have a better batting average at reducing inflation than Jerry Ford did. Anyhow, the same opposition that was made to Jerry Ford, namely that with a restrictive budget and so on, then inflation, then unemployment would go up. There is this problem with labor unions. Because of their particular ideology, they want to have more and more government expenditures, make work project, that sort of thing. How do you, as a head of state, can anyone do to convince labor unions that once you get into a double-digit inflation, if that is sustained for any period of time, it will lead to double-digit unemployment?
Well, I think this message is starting to be understood, and this is obviously part of the arguments we put to the Arbitration Commission when the hearings come forward. You know, we have had the example of the last 3 years. 1974-75, the government expenditure increased 46% and unemployment trebled in 1 year from about 78,000 to well over 200,000. So we've had that example. I think people are beginning to understand that if we want people to invest, if we want the private enterprise sector to create the productive jobs that a country needs, then those investors and entrepreneurs have to be convinced that a government is doing everything it can and will continue to do everything it can to overcome inflation. In the longer term, overcoming inflation is the only way in which you're going to be able to reduce unemployment in a permanent, stable and sensible manner. Of course it's true to establish make-work projects in the short term, but if those make-work projects are going to involve greater government outlays, greater government deficits, no proper way of financing that deficit, then the private sector is going to be squeezed more and more in the resulting inflation, and they'll lay off more and more people. Under those circumstances, I think it's very doubtful if the additional government employees would keep up with the reduction in employment in the private sector. And that again is supported by the experience of the last 2 or 3 years. And when people sit down and think, I don't believe they want their experience repeated. There's a role for management to play in this, explaining to their own employees what inflation does to their own company, to their capacity to invest, to their capacity to survive, to provide jobs. Many Australian companies are now starting to do this. Some of them having a special report to employees. I think they could have done much more of it over the past.
This is really the one reason I invited Mr. Kachanda to visit Australia. We've travelled all the mining areas and spoken to so many of the mining executives, and we're recruiting free market activists in the Australian mining industry and putting a free market message across. Just a, you may have heard of the Foundation for Economic Education. It was formed in the USA some years ago. I'll just leave a little bit of background with you on that for later.
Mr. Fraser, most of the environmental leaders in the United States were closet socialists until recently. Now they have come out and have identified themselves as dedicated, avowed socialists. A typical example is very common. A biologist at the University of Washington, I wrote a book called The Poverty of Power. He starts talking about the second law of thermodynamics, and then from that very adroitly he jumps into politics and says what we need is a new form of socialism. Now, I have reason to believe that the same condition exists in Australia from what I've read. I've heard that the Australian government is financing people such as the Australian Conservation Foundation. If so, should the government finance a pressure group whose aim is that of blocking industrial development?
Well, I think that's a very good question. The character of the Australian Conservation Foundation has in fact changed in recent times. The question of financing conservation bodies in this country is under review by the Minister and Department concerned. The Foundation has done some good work, and I think that shouldn't be forgotten. It's brought an increased awareness of the need to look at environmental factors, and I think miners accept that. But it's got to be done in a balanced and proper manner, and not in an obstructive manner that seems more designed to prevent projects proceeding than in just coming to a total balanced judgment, having in mind all the environmental and other factors. I think there is a role for government finance to enhance environmental bodies, and we certainly will continue to do so. But at the same time, we're working to achieve a situation in which environmental impact statements are undertaken sensibly and rationally, and this involves cooperation with the states, which I would believe we would be able to achieve. And at the same time, we want it done in a way that does not impede proper development. Again, I think a number of people are coming to realize that if the environmental matters are not handled appropriately, all it does is stop development, and all that does is create more unemployment. And that's not very good for the environment either.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Fraser, I have the definite impression that Australian unions are against uranium mining. Why do they oppose it? After all, uranium mining is just about as dangerous as copper mining. The upgrading of uranium ore to yellowcake is just about as lethal as electro-refining of copper. What happens if, let's say, the Fox report goes against uranium mining? Now, this 8 months from now, when this interview is published, the Fox report will have come out. But if it goes against uranium mining, then the unions will have the ideal blank check to go ahead with their obstructions. But this means that there will be, for the foreseeable future, no uranium mining in Australia.
Well, I think you're coming to a conclusion there that I wouldn't want to accept at this stage. I'll talk about the recommendations of the Fox Inquiry once they're made, but the government has quite religiously taken the view that we don't want to make any statements that would prejudice or preempt the results of that particular inquiry. But also to be said that some of the mines involved, or miners involved in uranium, have very much objected to the activities of their other unionist colleagues who were seeking to prevent the export of uranium to meet certain small contracts that we have for export only make that point to indicate that there's not a unity of view amongst the trade union movement in that particular question. But I think you'll understand me when I say that that is not going to be helpful if I comment on what may or may not happen after the Fox inquiry, because we don't in any sense want to prejudice the nature the objectives of this that were in mind when that inquiry was established. We'll obviously be making decisions in the light of the inquiry, but let's see what its recommendations are first.
Ron?
Yeah, we can hardly wait on that one.
Gene, well, it shouldn't be too long now, I don't think. Gene, I don't think it should be too long now.
Gene visited the three major uranium areas up there
yeah.
and met people like Owen Marshall, the manager of the... And he'd been sitting there for 40 years to manage the mine that hadn't appeared yet. So we sense the lost opportunities that Australia has had already.
I never. From
that all.
I understand that.
Could I just mention the Kalgoorlie problem, because I'm sure I'll be lynched if I get back to Kalgoorlie and haven't just sort of raised the thought there. We're really committed to the free market philosophy side of things, so we don't like subsidies any more than a lot of other people there. But I really see an opportunity in Kalgoorlie of translating some of the free market philosophy into reality by probably running it as a free market experimental workshop in many ways. And I'm just going to ask you off the top reaction to any proposal that could come forward from Kalgoorlie on the basis of it being thrown open as a deregulated area, perhaps area ranging from a 100-mile radius.
Again, the proper thing to do is to put that view to the Industries Assistance Commission and put it now.
It's deregulating it really is not asking for favours, as you said yourself.
Yeah, but it'd be enough with that good of the Assistant Commission. I think it's really put it to
them. Right. The deregulating would, of course, apply to, you know, the foreign investment guidelines and probably having exemptions from all sorts of
things. Yes, but those foreign investment guidelines haven't held up a single project. When I was in New York recently and speaking with New York financiers and business people, they were generally in warm approval of those guidelines, recognising that they protected the national interest and therefore protected their equity.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've got a situation where the Australian interest is not adequately protected in the view of a majority of Australians, they're the circumstances that you know, create uncertainty for the future.
Mm-hmm.
They recognise this just as well as we do. And therefore the partnership concept, where that's possible, is the one that safeguards their equity and Australia's national interest. But nobody has put any project to me that has been held up by those guidelines. I specifically asked for anything that might be held up to be put, so I can see. Nothing has been.
That really answers my question.
Yes, I understand that one of the first things you did when you became Prime Minister was to get rid of the Ministry for Media.
Yes.
Marvellous. I read some material by Dr. Cass yesterday. I was horrified. I'll be talking about freedom of speech today at the press club.
Good. Well, good luck at the press club.
Thanks.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.